Welcome to another episode of The Armchair Directors, where each episode we take a look at one of cinema's great directors and their essential films. I'm your host, Alex Baker. In this episode, we are looking back at the great Billy Wilder and focusing on his comedy classic, Some Like It Hot. Returning on the show today to talk about Some Like It Hot is Professor Mary Dutter. Professor Dutter, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much.
Syncopators, does that mean you played that very fast music, jazz?
Yeah, real hot.
Oh, well, I guess Some Like It Hot. I personally prefer classical music.
So this is the second time I've seen this movie, and it made me laugh more this time than even the first time, which is saying something.
Yeah, there's Billy Wilder has great comedy timing, mm-hmm. anyways, in some of the movies that he did, and even in some of the movies that were more serious, with the kind of dialogue that you see in Double Indemnity, that mm-hmm. stuff can make you laugh too. So yeah, him and I.L. Diamond really knocked it out of the park on this one.
Yeah, I think one of the funniest lines, because there's so many like gangster parodies in this movie, but it's George Raft, and he's like, "These are all my lawyers. They're all Harvard men." I just cracked up at that line.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things too is that unfortunately sometimes things can get a little dated too. Like, I always laugh when they first run into Sugar in the bathroom on the train, mm-hmm. and you know, she says, "I come from a musical family. My mother was a singer, my dad was a conductor." And they're like, "Oh, where was he a conductor? Oh, on the Baltimore and Ohio." And like when students see that now, they have no idea, and that falls completely flat. But I always crack up on that one.
So tell us about the hitman, the screenwriter in this movie, because I have to say this has some of the best dialogue in any movie I've seen. It's just hilarious, which Billy Wilder is definitely best known for.
Right. Well, the thing is, Billy Wilder, and when you like listen to Jack Lemmon talk about his collaborations with Billy Wilder, because Jack Lemmon actually was in 7 of Billy Wilder's movies, and all 7 of them were collaborations between Billy Wilder and I.A.L. Diamond, or some people call him Izzy Diamond. And they had a really amazing career together from about 1957 all the way through 1981, where they were just... Billy Wilder was the kind of person where he liked to write his own stuff. But he also thought that collaboration was really important. And not only was collaboration important, but you kind of had to fight for the ideas that you thought were good enough to make it into the script. So I know you've had a previous armchair director on Double Indemnity. So,
yes.
And the collaboration between Wilder and...
Raymond Chandler.
Yes, Raymond Chandler. And how contentious that was, because Chandler was all about kind of working alone and doing his own thing, and how Billy Wilder was always up in his face, and Chandler kind of left every once in a while and said, mm-hmm. you know, I'm not coming back to this. I can't deal with this guy. But I.A.L. Diamond and Billy Wilder just really clicked together. And they would, you know, get together and essentially just kind of sit in a room for hours, and one person would man the typewriter and the other person would pace, and then they would switch off. But mm-hmm. they just, like, hammered and hammered on things and fought hard, but still were able to respect each other at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. So their collaborations that ran for, you know, over 20 years were very successful. I mean, they did The Apartment together right after this, and that's where, you know, Jack Lemmon won his Academy Award for Best Actor. So, mm-hmm. I mean, their collaboration was really solid.
So it's interesting about, I was looking up some stuff about Some Like It Hot. This was actually a remake of a French film. It was
yes.
called Fanfares of Love. So I've never seen it. And when I looked about it, like on, you know, IMDb and Wikipedia and other databases, like there's very little written about it. So have you seen it?
No, I haven't seen it. But the thing is, when you listen to like people talk about how the process of this movie came to be, yeah, it's based on that. But one of Billy Wilder's things that he really, really wanted to do was he wanted to do some kind of take on the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. Mm-hmm. And when he was talking about that, he's like, you know, he really wanted to work that in. And what's kind of interesting is that it takes up a very, very small portion of the movie, although it is the thing that drives the plot along, because the two guys see the murder, then they have to flee, and then they're mm-hmm. being chased. But when he went to approach Jack Lemmon with the idea for the movie, and even when he did it with Tony Curtis before they even had Jack Lemmon involved, and they were trying to get Frank Sinatra to be Jack Lemmon's character, they were saying, okay, so it's the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. You witness it. You have to run. The only way you can get away is to be in women. So 80% of the time you're going to be in drag. Do you want to do it? And both of the, you know, both Jack Lemmon and Tony Curtis were like, yes, sir. So, but yeah, I don't know very much about the French film that it's based on. And I know that the premise is very similar, but I don't really see a lot in all kinds of, because there's been, you know, tons of coverage of this movie, you know, ever since it came out, because it's, you know, such a classic. But they don't really ever bring up the original movie.
Yeah, it's just weird because I was like trying to look up stuff about it, and there's just very little written about it. You think because it's a basis for a classic movie, has this connection to it, you think there be a bit more, but there's not. It's just strange.
Yeah, and a lot of times there is a lot more attention given to that, because like when you think about something like The Birdcage, it's really easy to find La Cage aux Folles. I mean, and mm-hmm. they're both really excellent movies. So perhaps the first movie isn't all that great. I'm not really sure, but I know, like, especially with stuff that's, you know, connected with Hitchcock, when he would take, like, a pulp novel and, you know, do radical changes to it to make it his own. It wasn't that, you know, the original work wasn't all that great, but a lot of times it was just kind of, like, really kind of secondhand material and a jumping off point for when you can make something a lot better. So that might be it.
And, you know, it's strange. This is kind of a time where you see a bit of change in Wilder's films, because in the 40s and early 50s, his films were pretty dark. You had Sunset Boulevard, Double Indemnity, Ace in the Hole.
Yeah.
And those films all had these very bleak, dark endings. And this one's definitely very lighthearted and fun. So I wonder how he got to change his tone out of his movies.
It's kind of interesting because, you know, you're coming out of, you know, when you've got what's going on in the 1940s with World War II and the end of World War II and the beginnings of the Cold War, and you see that, you know, reverberated in so many different aspects of society. I mean, that's where we get, like, film noir, because you have all these kind of subconscious things rising inside any kind of art form. And then when we get to the 50s, that's not to say that there wasn't a lot of tension there either, but you do see the mood lightening quite a bit. So when you see, like, this movie and The Apartment coming out, and you see, like, the kind of things that Marilyn Monroe was in, like The 7 Year Itch, because he did 7 Year Itch with her. Yeah, there definitely is a more move into comedy, and he's so brilliant at it that, you know, he excels. He excelled pretty much in anything he did. He could do a film noir, he could do a comedy, he could do a drama. You know, it's not like, you know, where you see, okay, John Ford does westerns, John Ford does war movies. Billy Wilder could basically do anything. And he had, you know, the team that he had for this movie, not only the acting, but the cinematographer on this was amazing. You know, everybody, you know, the writing was amazing, the acting was amazing. Mm-hmm. You know, he had, they won the best, the Academy Award for Best Costumes, being with Orr Kelly, because not only was he dressing Marilyn Monroe, but he was also dressing these two guys.
Yeah.
So, you know, he just really kind of assembled a great group. And it, you know, was a lightening of the time. Now, we get into the 60s and things start to get much darker and a lot more experimental or risque when you have, you know, the motion picture production code go away and get replaced by a rating system and people start doing all kinds of crazy stuff. So you're right on the cusp of things really starting to change from, like, an ideological point of view in America, but it's right before that point.
Yeah. And, you know, it was like you said, this film was actually relatively controversial at the time. It was considered very risque. I think it was condemned by the Catholic board.
Yeah, the Catholic League of Decency.
Yeah.
Yeah, they, and, you know, it's they're a really interesting group, too, because when you look at the kinds of things that they condemn, and they're pretty much active through to about the 1980s, early 1980s, and then you really don't hear about them very much anymore. But, you know, they had a field day in the 60s with all the kinds of things that were coming. You know, Sam Peckinpah alone would have, you know, just sent them into, you know, absolute orbit. But, because you see a lot of censorship happening before movies come out because of the production code and them saying, you know, in this pass-fail system that they had, okay, you have to do this, you have to take this out in order for it to even be shown to a general audience. But this film actually didn't get touched very much by the production code. Now, when they first showed it to an audience, and Jack Lemmon talks about this in interviews, he's like, the first time they showed it to an audience, they hated it. And so, you know, Wilder was really worried about this, obviously, because, you know, they had spent all this time, all this effort. They had gone way, way over budget on the film. The film went, like, $500,000 over budget.
Wow.
And it only cost $3 million to make, so that kind of gives you a sense of scale with all the problems they ran into with Marilyn Monroe. So, you know, this was already a gamble for the Mierce brothers that were doing the production on the movie. So what Wilder did was he actually went in and only cut a very, very small scene out where they're on the train and Jack Lemmon's character is about to turn around and say to Marilyn Monroe's character, "I'm a guy." And instead of Marilyn Monroe being there, it's actually Jerry or Tony Curtis's character. And Tony Curtis is just like, "You can't do that." That's the only thing they cut. They showed it again to another audience, and the audience loved it. So it's still, you know, one of the things that they were trying to do with setting it during the 1920s was to try to distance it from the current time. Because if they can put whatever wrong or bad is going into another era or another time period, then it doesn't look like it's a contemporary problem. So the whole cross-dressing thing, which, you know, would have sent people into orbit all around the country, especially in the more conservative areas, and the amount of sex that's in it. And not only sex, but, you know, sex without marriage, too, because that's, you know, another point that the Catholic League of Decency would have had a lot of problems with. And, you know, the drinking and, you know, yeah, you're right. It's kind of like a little parade of sin in this movie. But they didn't end up having to cut anything, at least from the motion picture production side. They cut that one scene simply because it didn't play well with audiences.
Wow, that's interesting.
But, yeah, the Catholic League of Decency did come out and say, you know, if you're a good Catholic, you really should not go see this movie. Which probably ended up helping it. You know, with something like that, or, you know, you get the whole, ooh, something must be really interesting about this movie. Let's go see it. And it was Marilyn Monroe. I mean, there was a lot of people that were going to see it anyways. So,
yeah. And like we talked about this earlier, I just love this film because it's just like an homage to the classic gangster films of the 30s. I mean, they have George Raft in there.
Yes.
And I love the little Scarface reference they have to the guy flipping the coin. He looks at him like, "Where'd you get that act?"
Yeah, I love that. I mean, like in my class, in the American cinema class I teach, we watch Scarface, we see George Raft, and George Raft, he's not necessarily a running joke in my class, but the thing was, George Raft could have had an amazing career, because he was up for the role of Rick Blaine in Casablanca. He turned it down. He was up for Walter Neff's character in Double Indemnity, and he turned that down. So whereas you see, you know, what happens with Humphrey Bogart, what happens, you know, with some of these other people that take these other roles that he just flat turned down, you know, you can kind of see where his career could have gone. I mean, he does end up, it's not that he doesn't have a good career, but he doesn't have like a blockbuster great leading man career. So when you see the callbacks and Edward O'Brien being in this,
yeah,
and, you know,
Angels
just all kinds
faces,
of, yeah, I love it. You know, it's just, it's almost, you know, it's pretty much an homage at the same time that it is something that's contemporary for the audiences of 1959.
Yeah, I love those little jokes at the funeral parlor. Its name is Mozzarella.
Yeah. Yeah, the whole thing is just like, is so funny. And, you know, it's the spats, you know.
And the, their disguise at the hotel is that they're friends of Italian opera.
Yeah, and the whole thing about, you know, "Where were you?" "I was at Rigoletto's." "Well, what's it, where was he that day?" "No, it was an opera, you ignoramus," you know, so.
Yeah, and they go, "Oh, he was like, oh, the nice cake." It's like, yeah, something in his stomach didn't agree with it.
Yeah, right. And it's so cool, too, because, you know, there's a scene in Scarface where you've got Scarface and all of his boys, and they're at a play, watching the play, and, you know, they get called away, and it's like, they have to go and put out a hit on this one guy that's been giving them all the trouble, you know, Boris Karloff's character. And Tony doesn't know if he wants to leave because he really wants to see what happens at the end of the play, and then they're able to work that kind of, you know, artistic aspect of these, you know, rough and tumble gangsters into this movie. It's just, it was such great writing in this movie.
And so, was this the first, like, big showcase for Marilyn Monroe? Because I know earlier in her career, she had, like, kind of cameo roles in, like, Asphalt Jungle and All About Eve. But was this, like, the first big hit for her?
That would be Seven-Year Itch. Seven-Year Itch really put her on the map. And that was about, that was several years before with Billy Wilder. And that really kind of, I mean, she was already a big star, and a very well-known kind of household name, but that one just really kind of put her over the edge as far as being, you know, notoriety-based. And so when they were putting this film together, originally they wanted Mitzi Gaynor to be Sugar. And, Marilyn Monroe approached Billy Wilder and said, you know, I'd like to be in another one of your movies. And so they went ahead and scrapped the Mitzi Gaynor idea right away and said, okay, Marilyn Monroe's going to be in this movie. But unfortunately, she's only alive for a couple of years after this. Mm-hmm. And she only does a couple more projects before she commits suicide. And this kind of goes into some of the psychology of what was going on with Marilyn Monroe, but she desperately didn't want to fall out of favor with her audiences. So, for example, she had a contract, and a clause in her contract said that she wasn't going to appear in any black and white movies, which caused a lot of problems with this movie because they knew ahead of time that this was going to be a period piece. They wanted it to be in black and white. The cinematographer had done a lot of great work in black and white. When they did makeup tests for the guys with all the, because they had to put really heavy makeup on those guys, as you can possibly imagine.
Yeah, you can tell.
And it was having them kind of show up a little bit kind of lime green, tinted green, on the film tests. So they were like, we're doing this in black and white. They had to actually renegotiate Marilyn Monroe's contract in order for her to be in this movie, because she felt that, and this is still true today, that young people don't want to watch black and white movies. And she just wanted to continuously stay relevant to her audience because, you know, she got a lot out of her relationship with the people that adored her. Because she had an incredibly hard life. I mean, her mother and her grandmother were both confined to mental asylums. She was in and out of foster homes her entire childhood. There's, you know, allegations that she had been sexually molested while she was in these foster homes. So she's always looking kind of for someone to love her. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, being a film star, being, you know, a model and having all this, you know, adoration, she really liked that. And she didn't want that to ever go away. And unfortunately, as is true today, you know, you get past a certain freshness point and you're going to start losing your audience. So this is unfortunately actually towards the end of her career.
You were talking about earlier, but the cinematography was by Charles Lang, and he was Academy Award winner. He's done a bunch of famous films. So
yeah,
it's interesting that they're talking about how, you know, they stayed with black and white at a time when everybody was kind of going to color, and black and white was sort of seeming obsolete.
Yeah, and there's a lot going on with him because, you know, not only was he, you know, nominated for 18 Academy Awards, and, you know, in his career, once he gets, you know, past this, he starts working more and more in color and gets a lot of notoriety and recognition for that. But, you know, he goes all the way back to silent film. His first film was in 1927. And he's known primarily in the 1930s for, you know, his excellent cinematography and working with filters and working with kind of diffused lighting, which is why people like Marlene Dietrich really loved working with him, because they always ended up looking so beautiful in his movies, which probably gave Marilyn Monroe a little bit more confidence, you know, given the fact that, you know, she wanted, you know, to be, you know, look as beautiful as possible and that she didn't want to be in a black and white movie. But you really couldn't have put it in a better person's hands. But one of the things about Long is that he liked to do long tracking shots. There's not a lot of long tracking shots in comedy. And so you see every once in a while, because, again, Wilder's about cutting on, you know, the beat and making sure that things are moving along and pacing. When you start looking for longer takes that last maybe past 15, 20 seconds in the film, it really gives you a sense of where Long is trying to work himself in. And there is a sequence on the boat when it's Tony Curtis and Marilyn Monroe, and he's doing his, you know, junior, Shell Oil Junior. And again, you kind of have to get back into all the things that were going on with Marilyn Monroe at the time. It's famous how many times that she had to do certain takes of this movie. That, you know, sometimes they were upwards past 40 takes. So there's a take on the boat where he's trying to explain to her his condition about how, you know, women just, you know, don't do anything for him, and you know, kind of baiting her on about, you know, how, you know, he just needs that one woman that's going to, you know, do it for him. And he's eating a chicken wing, and it's a long take, if you watch it, if you go back and look at it, you know, they go from being, you know, kind of screen left over. He goes, he gets the chicken, he's talking to her, she comes in close to him, he takes a little nibble off the chicken, they kiss, she kisses him back, they break, and he's like, nope, didn't do anything for me. He takes another little bite of the chicken, and then, you know, you follow them around, and he goes and lies down on the couch again with the chicken bonus, talking about how Sigmund Freud has mm-hmm. already seen him on his couch, yeah. And you don't get a cut until a little bit later. That's one of the longest cuts, actually, in the whole movie. And because we're at a point in the movie where Marilyn is becoming less and less effective as an actress, like the first part of the movie when they were shooting the sequence in the train, she wasn't so bad, although that whole sequence where she's in that bathroom and talking about, you know, trying to stay away from saxophone players mm-hmm. and all that kind of stuff, she was actually drunk. Zuber talks about in his commentary track that she kept a thermos of vodka and orange juice next to her at all times. But she was at least getting through her takes. Like the stuff that happens in the upper berth with her and Jack Lemmon together and hiding from Sweet Sue, she got all that stuff in one take. But the further they go into the filming, the more and more she's having to do multiple takes. And he talks about the fact that they had to go through 47 chicken bones for that sequence, that long wow. shot sequence that Tony Curtis is chewing on that chicken. It's supposed to be pheasant, but he's chewing a chicken bone. So that gives you an idea as to how many times they had to reset that take. Mm-hmm. And then there was probably, when you think about it, a very significant conversation going on between Long and Wilder, and Wilder going, probably, can we just, you know, maybe do quicker cuts of this to get, you know, as much of this as possible before things fall apart. And when you watch that whole scene, it's an incredibly effective scene. It's a very intimate scene between the two before they actually start getting intimate. And I think that was probably a battle on set that was very ugly at the time mm-hmm. that they were doing it, because Wilder, because I even heard an interview with Wilder on that, and he was like, I felt so bad for the guys in this movie because it was all about what takes Marilyn got right. So if Marilyn got a take right and the guys weren't up to snuff, that's too bad. They weren't going to do it again just for the guys. And even Tony Curtis in an interview was talking about, it's very difficult because you had to be perfect on every single take, because if you weren't, that they were going to go with what Marilyn did. And so that did create a lot of animosity. A lot of times when you have these really, really popular movies, everybody wants to think it's like, you know, sunshine and happiness, yeah, and everybody yeah. had a great time, and, you know, it was just like one big party. But this was a very difficult movie to make and mm-hmm. to get through, especially towards the end.
Okay, so we're getting close to the end of my questions here. Is there anything I haven't talked about you want to cover now?
Okay. Well, there's a couple of things that Suber brought up in his commentary that I thought were really important. He said that comedy blocks panic and logic. And one of the things that I think that definitely comes through with is that there's times in this movie where things are completely ridiculous, mm-hmm. where it literally doesn't make any sense, where, you know, something just happens to occur to be able to drive the plot forward. And a lot of times when you know, that movie, especially when I watch it with my classes, and you get to that very last scene, and you've had all this excitement, it's been pushing all your buttons, you've had a chase scene, you know, all this stuff, and now they're on the boat, and you've had, and this is something else that Suber talks about, is it has the three Ds, desire, deception, and discovery. And he's like, you know, there's always got to be, especially in a comedy, somebody desiring something. And for all three main characters, they're all desiring something, whether it's safety or love or sex. They're all trying to attain something. Mm-hmm. And then you have these deceptions. And all three characters are deceiving. And it's not just the two guys. When Sugar tries to go after Shell Oil Jr., she's playing a role. You know, she's like, you know, yeah, we're society girls. And I love it when she turns around and throws the Sheboygan Conservatory of Music back at Curtis, who came up with that when they were trying to get on the train. And he just goes, good school. Yeah. You know, it's just like, it's so perfect because he just knows that he's getting a lie thrown back at him. But they're always trying to deceive everybody about who they are and essentially almost even what they want. I mean, we think that Joe wants to have just sex with her. That he doesn't mm-hmm. want to have. He doesn't want to be in love with her. He just wants her. Mm-hmm. And then later on in the movie, when he's about to shove off, I mean, right after he says, you know, well, you know, that's just what's going to happen. That's just life because we got to get out of here. So, you know, that's the way the cookie crumbles. Or he says something about, you know, when you're making an omelet, you got to break some eggs. Yeah, yeah. And she's just an egg at that point. And then when they see Spats Columbo and they really got to get out of there, he gives her that bracelet, mm-hmm. which is the only thing that's going to keep those two guys alive. And he gives it to her mm-hmm. because it's not just about the sex anymore. He actually really loves her. So he figures out it's not just about the sex, that he really likes her in a different way than all these other girls that he leaves with, you know, the half of tuba toothpaste all used up. And then with Sugar, she just wants the money, too. She talks about, you know, she's going to go down, she's going to get a millionaire, she's going to be rich because all she's ever been is poor. And then she gets with Shell Oil Jr. and, you know, she has this experience with him. And it just sounds like when she's talking about that dream that she has when she came back and she slept so well and she swam out to him and made his cocktails and took care of him. And she just falls apart when he says that he's got to go down to Colombia and marry somebody. Mm-hmm. Or sorry, Venezuela. And, you know, then she just realizes, hey, you know, it's not really just about, you know, just getting the money, that she actually kind of likes this guy, which is really kind of lame and shallow and lacks logic because A, all he's done is ever lie to her. I know she doesn't know that, but mm-hmm. B, they don't really know anything about each other. When you mm-hmm. look or deconstruct their date on the boat, it's just about her trying to, you know, to get him, you know, excited. Mm-hmm. She doesn't really know anything about this mm-hmm. guy. So the idea that she has fallen in love with him is also illogical. So there's all these things that don't work, and then you get up to that last line, well, nobody's perfect. And when I watch it with a class, and even when I watch it with other people, there's always this kind of laughter, this release at the end, like you're getting this payoff. It doesn't really mean anything. Like, when you sit there later on, you're like, okay, nobody's perfect. Well, does that mean that Osgood and mm-hmm. Jack Lemmon are, you know, going to go together off and get married and be together? No. These two people don't know each other at all either. But that sense of just kind of zaniness and the way that comedy allows us to kind of cut off any kind of pain, mm-hmm. have a good time, have a laugh, that we have to buy into that. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a special kind of suspension of disbelief from mm-hmm. an audience perspective that we want to go, that we want to feel better. And another thing that Super said was that comedy dissolves and it doesn't resolve. And I think that also kind of fits in with what's going on at the end of this movie, too. That's just, you know, nothing makes sense at the end. You've got two people, you've got, you know, Sugar and you've got the Tony Curtis character. They're still running from people. I mm-hmm. mean, that hasn't gone away. The you know, there's still going to be an investigation over the murder of mm-hmm. Spats Columbo, but I think for the most part people are going to be like, well, I'm glad he's gone. So they're still in the same boat. Nothing's been resolved for them other than the fact that they're together. And what we know about both of those characters is they're not incredibly honest people. Mm-mm. So their ability to stay together as a loving couple, especially when they know nothing about each other, is pretty low. And then there's Osgood and you know, what's going to happen with that? So it doesn't make any sense at
what's
the
mother
end.
What's mother going to think?
Yeah, exactly. So it's just like, it makes no sense at the end, but we're all happy.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, it's a perfect comedy in that sense. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's very interesting the way that just kind of fades out and has that, you know, nice happy music like, da-da-da, here we go, there's the end. And the end makes no sense.
Yeah. Okay, then so last question I have for you is, I know you said you teach this film in one of your classes. Tell us about the classes you teach.
So this semester I have three. I have Introduction to Film, which is Film 101. And then I have the Introduction to American Film. And then I have English 218, which is Introduction to Film and Literature, where we look at adapting literature into film.
Well, that wraps up this episode of The Armchair Directors. We have been talking about director Billy Wilder and his comedy classic, Some Like It Hot. Don't forget, you can listen to The Armchair Directors every Thursday at 9:30 a.m. and Sunday at 2:30 p.m. Professor Dutter, I want to thank you again for coming on the show today.
Thank you very much.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you. For The Armchair Directors, I'm Alex Baker, saying, nobody's perfect.
mind, Osgood. I'm a man. Well, nobody's perfect.